Tonight we need to begin with some questions, and I want to ask for audience participation. I'm going to ask you to raise your hand because I'm going to ask some questions, and I need to see if you recognize some of these things that I'm going to be bringing up. I want a show of hands to tell me who has heard the phrase, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Okay, pretty much everybody has heard that phrase, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Okay, next question. How many of you know the movie that made that phrase popular? Okay, a few. All right, so people knew that, the good, the bad, and the ugly with Clint Eastwood, even though it goes back to 1966, so it came out when I was a kid, and it's something that made that phrase popular. Another question. Raise your hand if you've even seen the movie. You've actually seen the movie. Okay. All right. Quite a few of you have seen the movie. Okay. I'm surprised. My wife told me, don't use that illustration. Nobody will know what you're talking about. So I'm glad that I didn't take her advice on that one. Don't tell her I didn't, though. All right. Well, the 1966 movie, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, is thought by many to be one of the best Westerns ever made. And that is, if you like to watch three dirty, mean men stare at each other in long, drawn-out gunfight scenes, then you might agree that it's a good movie. And it's clear from the advertisements and from the movie, if you saw it, who the good, who the ugly was and who the bad was. But it's unclear to me how Clint Eastwood's character deserves to be called good, because he was just a cold-blooded killer himself. Well, tonight, we come to a portion of David's life involving three people that could be called the good, the bad, and the ugly as well. Except in this case, it is unclear who we would call the ugly. Of course, we're talking about David's sin with Bathsheba, and the title of the sermon tonight is The Heart of Deception from 2 Samuel 11 and 12. And if you're familiar with that story, you know that the good would have to be Uriah. Man did nothing wrong. He didn't deserve anything that happened to him. He was a good guy. David, in this story, is the bad guy. But who's the ugly? I'm not going to call Bathsheba ugly because the text is very clear. She was quite beautiful. So it's not her. So who is the ugly in this story? It's the story itself. The story is ugly. And so the whole event is ugly, and so it's just an ugly, ugly story. And it's sad because one of the reasons I started this series on David is because he's such a positive character. But his conduct in this event is anything but positive, anything but admirable. It's not at all, not anything that we want to emulate at all. He demonstrates the heart of deception. And as much as I would like to just kind of skip over this passage and move on, I'm not going to do it because that's one of the downsides of deciding to preach a series of sermons from a text or about somebody's life. You've got to deal with the good, the bad, and the ugly, even with David when there is ugly. And besides, this text will give us some important lessons we need to learn. And it even contains, as we'll see at the end, a ray of hope in the midst of this great sin and ugliness and great despair. Plus, one of the things about the Bible that we need to understand is that the Bible records real life as it is. It records history as it occurred, not as we wish it would have occurred. It reveals the good, the bad, and the ugly, and that's what we're going to see this evening as we look at the life of David, or this portion of David's life. We're going to divide the section up into four parts, and we're going to read basically all of chapter 11 and a good part of chapter 12 as we work our way through it. So what we're going to see, first of all, is the fallen heart. David's heart falls. He falls hard, as we're going to see in just a moment. Then we have the part of the failed cover-up, and then we're going to have the full exposure. So he failed to cover it up, and then his sin is fully exposed. And then finally, there is a fallout declared as a result of his sin. And those are the four sections that we're going to look at here in 2 Samuel chapters 11 and 12. Well, let's look first of all at the fallen heart. the fallen heart. And let's read verses 1 through 4. And as I read through this text, I want you to notice the stark nature of this story, the stark nature of this narrative. So listen to that as we read through this. Beginning in verse 1 of 2 Samuel chapter 11. Then it happened in the spring, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants, and they destroyed, and all Israel, and they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David stayed at Jerusalem. Now when evening came, David arose from his bed and walked around on the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful in appearance. So David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" David sent messengers and took her, and when she came to him, he lay with her. And when she had purified herself from her uncleanness, she returned to her house. Stark narrative. In fact, there's very little dialogue. There's very limited dialogue. That's why it very much compares to the movie, The Good, the Bad, and Ugly, because there's very little dialogue in the movie. And so in this case, in fact, the only recorded words of anybody are in chapter and verse 3 when the servants tell David, guess what? Isn't that your Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the daughter of the wife of Uriah? In other words, Eliam was a servant of David, so David would have known who he was, and Uriah was one of his soldiers, and he would have known who he was. And so David should have listened to that and said, okay, wait a minute. This is not a good idea. This woman belongs to somebody else. There's just nothing here that just speaks to thought process going on in David's mind. And let's not get caught up. I don't want to get caught up in the idea and the discussion of whether or not David should have been at the battle instead of on his roof. A lot of times lessons get all wound up in David should have been at the battle, et cetera, et cetera. And the text doesn't say that. It just says, here's where he was, here's what he was doing, here's what happened. It just is a brief, stark narrative of facts of what happened. And there's nothing there in verse 2 to indicate that she was doing anything wrong by bathing on the roof. She probably thought she was in a safe place where she couldn't be seen. And so we're not going to get caught up in trying to say he was at fault and she was at fault for them being in this situation. But verse 3 is where the problem begins. When he saw her, instead of stepping back and saying, I don't need to see this and turn around and go do something else, his heart fell for lust. David, and just look at the narrative. The narrative says David stayed, David arose, David saw, David sent, David inquired, and then he sent and took her, and then he lay with her. And then she was bathing. She came to him, and after he did what he wanted, she left. She went home. Very, very simple narrative. And I think the reason it's that simple and it's so stark is to indicate the fact that this was just an ugly, ugly event. It's not trying to sugarcoat it. It's not trying to mask the awfulness of what David did. It's just laying it out in these very simple, very direct, blunt terms. What he did was awful. And what we see here is we see a very clear illustration of James chapter 1, verses 14 and 15. Keep your marker there. We'll come back to 2 Samuel chapter 11 in a moment. But turn over to James chapter 1 and verses 14 and 15. James chapter 1, verses 14 and 15 describe how this unfolded, what happened there. In James chapter 1, verses 14 and 15, we read this. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. This story in 2 Samuel 11 and 12 is a very clear and blunt illustration of this principle. He was tempted. He fell for it. It got its hooks in his heart. The serpent bit into his heart and got control of him. And he proceeded to commit the sin. And then death was the result of it. Death in many, many ways, as we'll see in just a moment. His heart was given over to the power of lust. And so that's how it unfolded. Very simple, very blunt, very direct. Well, let's go to the next thing, the failed cover-up. And that begins in verse 5, and it goes through the end of the chapter. So we're going to read, going back to 2 Samuel chapter 11, we're going to read verses 5 through 27. I just want to read the text. It's worth reading. I want us to just hear God's illustration or description of this event. Verse 5. The woman conceived, and she sent and told David and said, I am pregnant. Then David sent to Joab saying, send me Uriah the Hittite. So Joab sent Uriah to David. Again, very direct, very blunt, very deep explanation. Verse 7, when Uriah came to him, David asked concerning the welfare of Joab and the people in the state of the war. Then David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. I don't know if that's a metaphor for anything, but he wants him to go home to sleep with his wife. And Uriah went out of the king's house, and a present from the king was sent out after him. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. Now when they told David and saying, Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house? Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah are staying in temporary shelters, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? By your life and the life of your soul, I will not do this thing. So Uriah says the one thing that David should have said. When he saw her and wanted her, he should have been the one saying, I will not do this thing. That's why he's the bad and Uriah is the good. He says, it would be dishonoring to my fellow soldiers for me to go enjoy myself. And by this time you're thinking, you have to be wondering. Is Uriah wondering something? Is Uriah thinking, this is weird? Why did the king bring me back from the battlefront? Why is he talking to me? Why is he asking about my wife and asking me why I haven't gone? Why did he send a present what's going on here? But anyway, he's not going to go and enjoy himself while his fellow soldiers are not. Verse 12, then David said to Uriah, stay here today also and tomorrow, and I will let you go. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. Now David called him, and so David has another attempt here. He ate and drank before him, and he made him drunk. And in the evening he went out to lie on his bed with his Lord's servants, but he did not go to his house. So Uriah drunk was more honorable than David sober. Verse 14, now in the morning David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it to the hand of Uriah. So here's where the cover-up comes in. The second part of the cover-up. The first part of the cover-up was, all right, he goes to sleep with his wife, he'll never know and everything will be fine, I can get away with this. Verse 14, he comes up with the second, when that fails, he comes up with a second plan. I'll just get Uriah killed in battle. Now do you remember when I talked a while back about how David had developed a characteristic of deception and lying? This is a good example of that. David is good at deception. That's why I call it the heart of deception. He's lying. He's doing everything he can to hide the truth of what he did and to deal with the consequences properly. So then he said, he had written in the letter, verse 15, place Uriah in the front line of the fiercest battle and withdraw from him so that he may be struck down and die. So he wanted to make sure that Joab knew what he was supposed to do. Uriah's got to die. So it was, as Joab kept watch on the city, that he put Uriah at the place where he knew there were valiant men. The men of the city went out and fought against Joab, and some of the people among David's servants fell, and Uriah the Hittite also died. Then Joab sent and reported to David all the events of the war. By the way, put a pen there. Pause there for a second. Do you think that David was covering anything up from anybody? The woman was brought to the palace by servants. Servants would have been everywhere, possibly even in the room while he was sleeping with her. Certainly outside. They knew what was happening, so servants knew about it. Do you think servants weren't talking about it? They would have known what was going on. I don't know if Uriah knew what was going on, but he certainly had to be thinking things were weird. But anyway, so Joab gets this message from it. And probably, do you think Joab said, oh, he wants Uriah dead? Okay, we're going to make sure that Uriah dies. What do you think Joab was doing? Why does David want Uriah dead? And he probably asked a few questions. And he probably got the message back because servants talk. His servants would have been talking to David's servant. He probably had spies in the house with David. So he found out what was going on. And so he took care of business for David. Verse 19, and then he covers himself and makes sure that the messengers know something's going on. Verse 19, he charged the messenger saying, when you have finished telling all the events of the war to the king, and if it happens that the king's wrath rises and he says to you, why did you go near to the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? And then David referred back to a story from the book of Judges that everybody would know about. Who struck down Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal? That was Gideon. Did not a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebez? Why did you go so near the wall? Then you shall say, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. I mean, this is telling everybody what's going on, or at least these people that are involved, the messenger. Verse 22, so the messenger departed and came and reported to David all that Joab had sent him to tell. The messenger said to David, the men prevailed against us and came out against us in the field, but we pressed them as far as the entrance of the gate. Moreover, the archers shot at your servants from the wall, so some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is also dead. Well, the messenger apparently didn't want to wait to get David's wrath. So he just gets that news out there fast. Then David said to the messenger, here's the heart of deception. Listen to the cold-hearted, cruel way David spoke. This is a man who supposedly has a heart after God, but right now it's not thinking about God. Then David said to the messenger, thus you shall say to Joab, do not let this thing displease you, for the sword devours one as well as another. Make your battle against the city stronger and overthrow it, and so encourage him. And then, verse 26, now when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. So David's like, yeah, people die, too bad. Happens. Bathsheba's mourning. I don't think that Bathsheba was involved any way whatsoever in this plot. And that's why, again, don't want to get off into that. Verse 27. When the time of mourning was over, look what David did. He sent and brought her to his house. She became his wife. And then she bore him a son. But the thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. He thought he was hiding it from everybody. He wasn't hiding it from very many people. And he most certainly wasn't hiding it from God. And so we see the failed cover-up of his sin. The next thing we see is the full exposure. So if David was hiding it, at least maybe some of the people didn't know about it, it got exposed. The deceit and the awfulness of what he had done became exposed. Chapter 12. This is in verses 1 through the first part of verse 7. And this is a story where Nathan comes to him and sends the prophet Nathan to him. Nathan is the one that told him, you know, go build the house for the temple, build a temple for the ark. And God said, no, you can't. Go tell him this. And so Nathan and David were friends. They had a good relationship with him. And so Nathan was bold enough to go after God sent him. knowing that this was not going to go well, or not knowing how this was going to go. Because David had already killed one person, and actually we don't know how many other people got killed in that fight, just so he could make sure Uriah died. Chapter 12, verse 1. Then the Lord sent Nathan to David, and he came to him and said, there were two men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a great many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he bought and nourished, and it grew up together with him and his children. It would eat of his bread and drink of his cup and lie in his bosom and was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man. He was unwilling to take from his own flock or his own herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. Rather, he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. And so this would be a common thing for someone like Nathan or somebody to bring a case to the king to be judged, something, and especially if it involves a rich man who may be powerful, that they need the king to step in. And so David probably has no idea that this is not that exactly where this is going. He thinks some guy has done, some evil rich guy has stolen some poor guy's lamb. And David is angry. Verse 5, then David's anger burned greatly against the man, and he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, surely the man who has done this deserves to die. All right, so in his mind, the guy who took a lamb deserves death. But that's not the penalty for theft. Verse 6, he declares judgment. He must make restitution for the lamb fourfold, because he did this thing and had no compassion. Not only was David speaking out of guilt or just genuine anger that somebody would do this and did not make the connection. Yeah, if he didn't make the connection, Nathan made it for him in verse 7. Nathan then said to David, you are the man. Can you picture that? The king, he's already killed people to try to cover this up. And here comes David, or Nathan, and saying, here's this evil guy who did something evil, and gets David so angry he wanted to kill the guy, and then he looked at him and said, it's you. You're the guy who did this. You want this man to be punished, deserves death? It's you, David. Talk about a club upside the head. That's what that would have felt like. That would have been a gut punch to get that news. But Nathan told him, the story now is out. The truth is out. And it's not going to be hidden from anybody, no matter how hard David tried to cover it all up. Well, let's go to the... And yeah, I did want to say this. In Psalm 32, and don't turn there, but just mark Psalm 32, verse 3, and read this at some point. I want to read it for you, just I've written it out here. Psalm 32 seems to imply that David's guilt was eating at him. Because it says in verse 3, when I kept silent about my sin, my body wasted away through my groaning all day long. So it seems like David's heart was eating at him because of his sin, but he didn't do anything about it until he was confronted and exposed. And so that's where we get to the fallout. The fallout is in verses... last half of 7 through the verse 14, and this will be the last of our reading. Look at beginning in 7, verse 7 again in chapter 12. After he says, you are the man, he says, thus says the Lord God of Israel, it is I who anointed you king over Israel, and it is I who delivered you from the hand of Saul. I also gave you your master's house and your master's wives under your care, and I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have added to you many more things like these. Why have you despised the word of the Lord by doing evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with a sword and have taken his wife to be yours and have killed him with the sword of the sons of Ammon. Now, therefore, here are the consequences. Here's the fallout. The sword will never depart from your house because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. I will even take your wives before your eyes and give them to your companion, and he will lie with your wives in daylight. Indeed, you did it secretly. But I will do this thing before Israel and under the sun. Then David said to Nathan, and this is where we see David's heart, and we see the ray of hope. Then David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said to David, the Lord has taken away your sin. You shall not die. However, because by this deed you have given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also that is born to you shall surely die. So despite the ray of hope, despite the heart of contrition, awful consequences are coming to David's house. This son, the son of adultery, will die. Another son will rape a sister and then be murdered by another son, who then will lead a rebellion and take David's concubines publicly on the roof of the palace in front of everybody before being killed in battle. Consequences of sin are terrible. The heart of deception brings nothing but deceit and devastation and despair. But even in the midst of that, there's a ray of hope, and that is of the forgiveness that God offers. And well, let's look at some takeaways, and then we'll be done for tonight. Some takeaways. First of all, guard your hearts. I'm talking especially to all you young married couples. Guard your hearts. Because do not think that this cannot happen to you. It happens. And it happens. And it happens all the time. Especially working in professional environments where you're around people, intelligent, educated people, and people who look nice and work, and it happens. I was listening to one guy talking about this. He said, yeah, said don't ever think that you can get excuse this by saying, well, she smells so nice. I don't care how nice she smells. If she's not your wife, don't be sniffing around her. Don't open your heart to temptation. Close your heart to temptation. Keep those things away. Whatever it might be, make sure that you keep yourself focused on your wife or on your husband. Second thing, if your heart strays, repent and confess quickly, especially when caught. Lying only makes it worse. Repent and confess quickly. Third thing, accept the consequences without complaint and move on. Accept the consequences. Because sin will bring consequences. Maybe not all the time, but sometimes, most of the time it will. And no matter how much God will forgive us, those consequences don't go away. That's why you need to guard your heart. But if the consequences come, accept them. And just plead for God's forgiveness. And then the last one is, don't brag because it wasn't you. Don't look at David or don't look at the person who's fallen and say, oh, well, it wasn't me. At least I didn't do that. Well, then you're guilty of pride and contempt. Let's not do that as well. Don't brag. It's not you. And don't, also because it might be you next. Don't get the big head. Keep a small, humble heart before God. Those are your takeaways. Let's just wrap up with one question. Go ahead and close out your song, this Bible, and open up your song books. We're going to sing the song of invitation. And we're just going to ask this question. And this is something that not only is this something that must be done at the beginning of becoming a Christian, but it's something that has to be done on a continual basis as we work out our faith before God. Circumcise the heart of deception. When we see lies and deceit or any kind of temptation coming into our heart and trying to take root there, cut it out. Kill it. Burn it out. Do whatever it takes to get that out. And let the ugliness of our sin be made clean in the blood of Christ. Will you do that tonight? If you need to be right with God in any way, let us help you do that now. Please come while we stand, while we sing.